From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the spacious Argo Studios in New York City, surrounded by snow. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help us keep this show on the air. Over the past 4 weeks, you've heard a series of interviews that we conducted under the title A Prophetic Vision for a New Year, Where We're Going, How We'll Get There. Our aim was to highlight a few of the many religious leaders who are charting a new course for engaging faith in the pursuit of justice and explore how they are succeeding at doing that within a social and political structure that can so often seem immovable. Overall, the series offered amazing inspiration as well as innovation. If you missed any of these conversations, I urge you to find the time to listen to them on our website, or if you prefer, to read the interview transcripts. But do that later, not now. Because on this week's show, I'll be discussing these ideas and initiatives and asking where else this kind of prophetic work is being done and by whom, with the Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson, president of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, and the Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch, senior religion editor for the Huffington Post. I'll also talk to Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief of the Religion News Service, about the role media coverage will play in helping or hurting this agenda. On February 8th, the highly effective Moral Monday movement in North Carolina is escalating its activism with a scheduled march on Raleigh, the state capital. Organizers describe the effort as the most massive moral rally in the South since Selma. No, there's nothing subtle about the work of the Moral Monday movement, founded by North Carolina NAACP head, the Reverend William Barber. But neither is there anything subtle about the regressive government policies that prompted this grassroots response, as Reverend Barber told us in our interview with him.
Our legislature in North Carolina, they denied 500,000 people access to Medicaid, 170,000 people unemployment. They've kicked 30,000 kids off of preschool, poor kids, raised taxes on 900,000 poor people to give 23 families a tax break, attack voting rights. It's almost like we're in an alternative universe that doesn't even line up with our deepest moral values and our deepest constitutional values. So what I want to see is us be a catalyst for a new moral conversation, not liberal versus conservative, not Republican versus Democrat, but what is immoral versus what is moral, what is extreme versus what is constitutional, a conversation about our common humanity.
In a separate conversation, William Barber described the chilling experience of challenging the government leaders of North Carolina, a government that's been more than willing to arrest thousands of peaceful protesters brought together under the Moral Monday banner.
When we went down to quote to them the Constitution, and to quote to them why this is a constitution and a moral issue and it's a democratic issue. And we said that it seems as though an anti-democratic cancer is trying to spread across North Carolina, and we intend to cut it out with the scalpel of the Constitution and our moral protest. The chair of the Board of Elections suggested in an article that me standing up with those students could be misperceived and it might cause somebody to retaliate against me violently. In essence, he basically suggested that if you don't shut up, somebody's going to deal with you violently.
Reverend Barber has effectively given voice to a movement that has brought together North Carolinians from across racial and partisan divides to relentlessly pursue justice, a campaign that has inspired like-minded people across the country to step out in their own communities in pursuit of Moral Mondays as well as the other 6 days of the week.
It's a time of joy and hope. I mean, how could it not be?
The Prophetic Voices series continued with the incomparable Sister Simone Campbell, executive director of the Catholic Network Lobby, who organized the remarkably effective Nuns on the Bus campaign for justice.
The very fact that the bus trip happened for me was an explosion of joy. And that is all because we touched reality. If you touch the pain of the world as real, not that you have to fix it, but just touch it as real, let your heart be broken, it releases hope into the darkness. It's a dark time. But yet, on the other hand, we can be light in this darkness for each other.
Sister Simone's far less concerned about any change in the Vatican's recent scrutiny of women religious in this country than she is heartened by the renewed focus on economic inequality demonstrated by Pope Francis.
For me, it is nourishment for the roots of my being, because Jesus in the gospel has always been about being with those at the margins of society. So to have Pope Francis, by his being, embrace people who are at the margins is such an affirmation of everything that my life's been committed to that my heart rejoices. Pope Francis says that it is low wages and this income inequality that's eroding our society and is the root of violence and is the root of prejudice, is the root of fear, and that the way forward is to address this structurally.
As Sister Simone Campbell takes a break from the road to focus on writing a book, it's characteristic of her to describe it as less of a memoir and more of a model for action, an instruction manual for how to get on that bus with her and with others who travel the rocky road toward justice and fairness for everyone. As the Prophetic Vision interview series continued with the Reverend Michael Ehrlich of Judson Memorial Church in New York City, a clear pattern began to emerge.
All budgets are moral documents. There is no separate conversation of how we break down the budgets of our state, our country, maybe even our household, from what our core moral values are. And, you know, if anything, I see the gospel as more practically relevant than ever before, mm-hmm. as we look at these moral documents and are recognizing that our faith over here cannot be separated from the decisions we make in the real world, you know, in government, in our businesses, in our families.
The leaders we were speaking with from a range of denominational, geographical, and generational backgrounds were bringing the same message. Economic justice is necessarily the fundamental issue of our times.
85 of the wealthiest people on this planet hold as much wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion, or half the world population on this planet. Oh. Wealth disparity undergirds any conversation we're going to have about spirituality and the relevance of our traditions. They're coming back around. They're reading the Bible and our tradition with fresh eyes and recognizing that there is something radical here. And we've maybe been asleep. Maybe we were glancing over those parts of the Bible, but that it's become more relevant than it ever has been.
In the final interview of the Prophetic Vision series, we heard from Valerie Carr, a Sikh American filmmaker and interfaith activist who founded the online Groundswell Movement Initiative.
We looked at the tools that we have that our parents and our grandparents never had access to. These tools of social media that we're no longer just dazzled by these tools or using them for self-expression, but that we could actually use these tools to organize in real and powerful ways. So if we use media to share stories and to inspire thousands of people to stand behind those particular stories, to call for social change, it connects us in very real ways, even if it's all online.
Valerie has long been preaching a new way of uniting around shared values, and she reiterated this point during our conversation.
It is the old way. It is the old way that we fight for our causes over and against one another. It is the new way, and more people in my generation are fighting this way, to stand in solidarity around shared moral imperatives.
So there's a quick review of the leaders we chose to highlight from among many others in our search for a prophetic voice for a new year, where we're going, how we'll get there. Dr. Catherine Henderson is the president of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. During her tenure, the seminary has become an incubator for daring new approaches in engaging people of faith and conviction in the work for social justice. both in its preparation of bold new leaders and in its role as a center for ideas and action, Auburn's a place that I'm proud to be associated with. Catherine, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, Welton. Thanks so much for having me.
The Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch is the senior religion editor at the Huffington Post. He brings an important perspective to this discussion. Paul, thanks for coming in to be with us on a busy day.
Great to be with you.
The whole idea behind this project that we did with Prophetic Voices was to try to identify some of those that we're going to be hearing over this year and beyond. I'm curious as to whether or not the two of you see the number of prophetic voices growing or declining.
Well, I would say that the number is growing and that some voices really do break through. I'm thinking of, you know, William Barber in North Carolina, who's the head of Moral Mondays and who has lifted up issues of voter suppression and income inequality. And so his voice is certainly breaking through and framing issues there, and also leading a movement that is now picking up in, I believe it's 11 states.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a kind of breakthrough voice. But there are moral leaders among his movement. Mm-hmm. And we had a couple of people from Auburn, staff people, who were there with him and heard a businessman who was a part of the movement. His business was making prison doors. And when he did civil obedience and found himself being locked in a jail cell, he knew that the door locking him in was probably a prison door that he had made.
Hmm.
So he was a surprising voice, perhaps not a prophetic voice, but prophets need echoes among followers. And this man was an echo, a surprising echo.
Yeah. Paul, what constitutes a breakthrough voice?
Well, I think all of the prophetic voices you've identified have really understood the use of the performative action of protest, of prophecy, that they've actually gone out there and done things. And they've actually, and I hate, you know, I say this, it's not a cynical way, but they've done things that the press can cover.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't just said, well, I wrote a blog about it. You know, I mean, they've gotten out into the streets. They've been able to be photographed. I remember Sister Simone going through the Capitol, praying and singing. And that's amazing because people can see it and they can say, oh, wow, you know, I'm a part of that. I can be a part of that through the media.
Yeah.
So what's very important, and I think that, frankly, prophetic voices have gotten much better at this, is that they've figured out a way to capture what they want to say with imagery, with some, you know, pageantry, which is very important. I mean, the walls of Jericho came down because people went around marching and they were, you know, you could see them. I think about, you know, Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Faith with this big golden calf that was amazing. And, you know, and then everybody wanted to take a photograph of it. It was very smart. So I think what we're seeing is smart people getting into this and using all of the resources that the media can offer for the betterment of their cause.
With as many voices in the public place that as we have now, how do we discern who's authentic?
I think that there are some litmus tests, and I think that the people who are trying to ignite the public imagination with questions like, what does human flourishing look like for all? How are we connected to each other? How are we responsible for each other's well-being in this society? How are we going to build the world around us in a way that speaks to the common good? Those would be the kind of values that I would say the true prophets would be lifting up, painting a picture of not as life as it is, but life as it could be that makes for human flourishing.
Mm, yeah.
The dignity of all, the access of all, to the good things of this world.
What do you all see as the issues that offer the most promise for us making progress as people concerned about justice as well as mercy and grace? In this coming year, what issues seem to have the most potential for us to actually measure some movement forward?
I think economic justice is the first one. That's the reason Pope Francis has made such inroads, is that people are so impressed that a religious leader is actually acting like a Christian and talking about the poor and doing it in such a forthright way. And it's resonating with people. So I think, first and foremost, the economic injustice that people see in this world, the fact that the rich have gotten so rich and the poor are either getting poorer or staying the same, that resonates with people. The other one, I would say, is very much around gender and sexuality. I think that's very important because it points to the way people are interpreting the Bible. It points to a wider way people understand the meaning of tradition, the way we can evolve, the way we can progress. Those churches that have continued to move forward on LGBT equality are really looking with a special kind of eye towards the value of tradition and the idea that revelation is still happening, that we know something now that we can bring to the faith table. And I think that's a very important aspect of what it means to be a prophet.
Mm-hmm. I guess in terms of issues, I certainly agree with the income inequality and how do we create a moral economy? What are the values of a moral economy that all can have access to meaningful work and that abundance is shared? I mean, we need to wrestle deeply with issues of a moral economy. I think immigration is still an issue. We don't really know which way that is going to go. And the question of who belongs in the society is still up for grabs. So immigration will still be there. And certainly, I agree with you, issues of sexuality, but also women's issues, reproductive rights, all of those gains that we had made that are being eroded in certain ways.
Yeah. But there are some issues that it really feels like their time has come.
I think that's right. The other thing I would put in here is voter rights. In the last election, those rights were so eroded and so in ways overt and subtle. And so we will need to still have to fight that fight.
I think that it's about issues, but it's also about this resurgence of the value of progressive religion to speak to these issues and to mobilize people on these issues. You can't just go into a church and talk about issues. You have to talk about yourself, your life, what gives your life meaning, how you are connected to your neighbor and to the earth. Those broader issues that actually this progressive religion, which kind of felt a little bit diminished over the past couple decades, feels like it's resurgence and saying, yes, we have a place at this table and it's necessary for going forward. So it's about how we do faith along with issues.
Where do you see signs of the faith-based movement for justice penetrating the halls of power? Now, every one of us has mentioned Sister Simone Campbell, and no wonder. Recently, she mentioned the fact of Senator Bernie Sanders saying that the people in Washington are bolstered in their arguments by the Pope's moral authority. Where else do you see this starting to happen?
I would say in the last election season, we saw great gains around marriage equality. In a number of states, we know from polling that was done as voters, you know, left polling stations that religion was a positive factor in changing their hearts and minds and votes around marriage equality. So that's a demonstrable, data-driven issue that religion was a factor in changing people's hearts and minds around marriage equality. I also think about what's happened for the Sikh American community in the tragic aftermath of the killings in Oak Creek last year. There was a lot of effort that was mobilized at the grassroots level and nationally that led to hearings on Sikhs in America, the first time that had happened, and now to legislation that will track hate crimes against Sikh Americans because they were tracked with Muslims before. So I think that that is an example of multi-faith leaders across religious traditions rallying.
I think something that just happened that's impressive is that Mayor de Blasio just has included Muslim holidays in the calendar. So we're recognizing that there is a real multi-faith fabric of this society that is an asset. I think that President Obama has really started to address this, that we are a broad tapestry of faith and no faith, and that all of us have something to contribute. And I think that kind of awareness, that kind of conversation has come about not accidentally, but because of the hard work of people like Dr. Henderson and others who have really worked to promote interfaith relations in this country. And so you can't really go out there and just say, well, it's all about Christian anymore. Well, there's a small segment, but that's a loser.
Right.
Today, it's a winner to talk about the interfaith movement and the importance of a multi-faith society.
Yeah. The commingling of religion and politics on the far right is something that's been a very serious concern for me and for most of us for a whole lot of years. And I've always been adamant in saying that the so-called left should never make the same mistake that was made by the religious right. I want us to watch the values of progressive faith communities and have them expressed, but not depending on government legislation to give them the status in our society that they need. Do you identify with that at all?
I certainly understand your concern, but I think what will help us from becoming that is to populate the public square with a broader range of voices, which is what you're trying to do with State of Belief. It's what Paul is trying to do with Huffington Post. And so it's trying to populate and to create a broader range of voices. You know, and I see that happening. And I think just in the language of a multi-faith movement for justice, it means that we're trying to be inclusive. We're not giving people a litmus test that they have to sign on to join the movement, that it includes Republicans and Democrats, and it includes people on a broad range of issues who may not stand together on one issue, but they may stand together on another, as we have seen, for example, working across many lines of difference around human trafficking. Yeah. That is a uniting kind of issue.
Yeah, I actually think that the idea of the left being beholden to some sort of religious authority, progressive religious authority, the monolith of progressive religious authority, is such a far-fetched idea that it's not really a possibility. But I do think that the idea of always recognizing the different roles that we have and not feeling that either one is beholden. I don't want my politicians beholden to any religious leaders and following any religious leaders, but I do want them inspired. Right. And I think that that's fine.
Catherine, I want you, I know this will be hard for you to do, but I want you to talk about some of the Auburn initiatives that you're most enthusiastic about, ways that the values that we're talking about right here are finding expression beyond the institution.
One of the most exciting initiatives is Mountaintop, where we brought together back in June about 80 faith-based justice leaders across many faith traditions, Christians, Jews, Muslims, and others. And what we're trying to do at Auburn, we're trying to build some infrastructure to equip, you know, bold and resilient leaders to do this work of healing and repairing the world. So part of that is trying to create an infrastructure and a way to knit people together so that they can work in concert and figure out how their collective energies can shape our public debate, but also action in the world. And so that was Mountaintop, and we'll be holding a second Mountaintop soon. We do a lot of media training. We've trained about 4,000 religious leaders to do what I just mentioned, populating the public square with a greater variety of voices on many issues. And we believe that technology gives us a great opportunity to do digital campaigning. And so we do a lot of training of religious leaders so that they will know how to use technology to highlight, to bring awareness to whatever issue is that they're working on, whether it's gun violence or human trafficking or income inequality.
Do we have the theology that we need as a foundation for seeing the interfaith movement grow stronger and stronger?
Well, one of the things I've been talking to young people, I was like, you should know how this should be your faith. You know, I remember talking to a group of pretty much all Lutherans, and they were like, well, my, you know, my cousin always tells me I shouldn't do interfaith. And I'm like, you have all sorts of things in your tradition that point towards interfaith cooperation. Many scripture passages about Jesus. You should know them. They should be right at your fingertips so you can counteract with that. That should be part of what you're learning in Sunday school. It should be part of what you're hearing Sunday. So, you know, I think that's true for everybody. Christians have a history of this kind of exclusivist idea of salvation. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it even more important that Christians begin to realize that maybe Jesus wasn't talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that our religious traditions do offer us resources that we can mine that teach us how we live together more peacefully. One of the things I'm so excited about in terms of the millennial generation is that they are used to connecting with each other right. as Christians, Jews, Muslims, and others across many lines of difference of race and ethnicity, and they do not have the barriers that they have to scale that we have put up in previous generations. So I'm excited. Maybe they can move farther faster because they start at a very different point.
Yeah. I wonder if the two of you have learned lessons about what works in advocacy for justice and what doesn't help us all that much as we focus on trying to energize and sustain and take forward this whole movement. What are the lessons that are important?
So I would point to something that we're doing now in Chicago. It's called the Table to Action Project. And it's we have come in at the request of folks there in Chicago because of the breaches that happened in the last election cycle, where LGBT activists and African Americans did not show up for each other in mutual ways, where in an election season the relationships were simply transactional. In other words, you help me so that we can win on our issue in this election. And it's created a situation where of mistrust. And so what we're trying to help is to bring around a repairing of the breaches between these two groups of religious leaders and activists. Mm-hmm. And it's working. But I think the lesson to be learned is that we have to be in relationship with each other. We have to sit at the table and share food. We have to hear and respect each other's stories. We can't simply be in transactional relationships. It has to be real. And it's a lot harder to repair when those relationships are broken than it is to create them from the beginning.
Mm. Bob?
Well, I've never not had a success. So I've just gone from glory to glory. So I don't really know what you're talking about.
Well, I do want to ask you about humility in a minute also.
Oh, I'm the best at that as well. I guess the one thing that comes to my mind is how important really good worship is. This sounds counterintuitive, but having people come to church, having or wherever they're going for spiritual fulfillment, having this be integrated but not overshadowing the fact that we all have lives, that some of us have mothers with Alzheimer's, some of us are sick, some of us ourselves, we can hear all this about the poor over there, but some of us are freaking out because we think we're going to lose our job and we don't have enough money. Yeah. And so to realize that our time together in community is so valuable, and to make worship count and to be there for one another in a way that is transcendent and yet very, very imminent with one another and with the divine, and not to lose sight of that in the face of the important issues that we're approaching.
Gosh, I am so glad you said that.
I just want to add another. Now that you've got us going, we're gonna think of lots of tips. Wellness. I think that justice takes a lot of resilience. It takes health. It takes well-being. And it's often overlooked. I mean, we literally kill our prophets sometimes, and we certainly work them to the bone, partly because we let ourselves be worked to the bone. Movements happen over dead bodies sometimes. And so One of the initiatives that we're working on is called the Sojourner Truth Leadership Circle, where Lisa Anderson at Auburn is working with right now with African-American women activists and leaders of organizations around how to create wellness for themselves through their connections with each other, but how to take the steps so that they can sustain the work for a lifetime.
Paul, I do want to ask you, as you curate the religion section at the Huffington Post, and by the way, I think all of us are in your debt, in Huffington Post debt, for what
yes.
you've done for understanding different religions. But what are the big challenges for you?
The big challenges are to help people find things that will be positive and not go for just the negative news. Because there's so much negative news. And part of the attraction to going for the negative news is that we are all consumers of negative news. We know that. We prefer stories that are bad and make us angry. What we really try to do is, how can we, you know, recognize that we have to acknowledge all the horrible things that religion does sometimes. We have to report on that, but also to really lift up beautiful stories that often don't get told and don't involve the big prophets, but maybe are small stories that are still beautiful and important, not just chasing numbers, but really going for the small and beautiful stories that are day-to-day faith life. And that's important to keep that in mind. Not to sell out is a really big challenge, and not to get frustrated. Some days I just look at the news and I'm just like, oh my God. And I think anyone who works in religion feels that sometimes. Yeah. That there's just, especially if you're religious yourself.
I want to go back to your earlier statement about worship and connect those for a second, because I want to tell you a good story that came out of worship, and it happened in the congregation that I pastor in Louisiana. You all don't know our community, but you do know that Louisiana is not the hotbed of liberalism in the South. I do a lot of interfaith preaching in our church. In the year that Ramadan ended amid all of the controversy about burning the Quran, we had talked about in the church. I had members of the congregation come after worship one day and say, we want to go to the Islamic Center of Northeast Louisiana and worship with them on the day Ramadan ends. There were all kinds of threats out. We were welcomed so warmly. And I have to tell you, that worship service was one of the most meaningful moments in my life, because we were different, but we were worshiping the same God, and we were wanting the same things: forgiveness, comfort, healing, all of the things that you mentioned. So I just have to put an exclamation point after what you said, because there is a direct line between worship and justice and peace and all of these other things that we're so interested in. Now, a question for both of you. Who do you see as being particularly effective? Who inspires you? Who is making outstanding contributions in leading the charge for justice these days in fresh and effective ways?
Well, I think we've mentioned some of my heroes. William Barber would certainly be one, Sister Simone Campbell, Pope Francis, and it's surprising for me to say that, because I've never particularly focused on the Pope and the Pope's leadership, on a Pope's leadership, but I'm finding the Pope very accessible and inspiring, you know, partly because I'm excited to see how many hearts and minds he's able to touch. I would mention Rabbi Sharon Brous in L.A., who is the founding rabbi of ICAR, which is focusing on social justice. I mean, it is marrying exactly what you were just talking about, which is the best of worship and prayer and ritual with the work of justice. And I would mention Valerie Kaur, who is at Auburn, founder of Groundswell, who is a filmmaker and a Sikh American who is using the power of law. She has a law degree. She has a religion degree. She understands the use of power for good. And she is a media personality that is increasingly being seen in many news outlets.
Paul, what about you?
The two people that come to mind are young African-American pastors. One is named Otis Moss III, and the second is named Tony Lee. Tony Lee is in Maryland, right outside of D.C., and he does amazing work. He gets himself tested for HIV in the pulpit 4 times a year. He works with gangs. He is so in the community, and he's one of those stories that he's not a big, you know, everyone knows his name kind of guy. He's doing the work of the gospel in his community right there where it matters. And I just, he's one of these people who I just admire so much. Reverend Otis Moss is also amazing. He comes from a line of ministers, but he also is one of those people who brings it in worship. So you people are feeling the Spirit, but they are also learning something amazing, and they are being rallied for something important. And he has spoken out in an extraordinary way about marriage equality in a way that can be heard so that people can respect their own tradition but recognize that they still need to stand with someone else. Even if they don't completely agree, they have to recognize this is part of who I am. And so, you know, I've been so impressed with both of them. And I think what they're doing is this kind of really in their community making a difference. And I think that's where prophetic work starts.
I've been speaking with Dr. Catherine Henderson, president of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, and the Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch, senior religion editor at the Huffington Post. As a capstone to our month-long series of interviews, a prophetic vision for a new year, where we're going and how we'll get there, I think this has been a really valuable overview of exactly those concepts with two people that are deeply involved in both observing and promoting them, and two people whose voices we certainly appreciate and need to keep hearing. Paul and Catherine, thank both of you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Welton.
State of Belief would like to acknowledge the partnership of Auburn Seminary and the support of the May and Samuel Rudin Family Foundation in New York for the Prophetic Vision Series, a month of conversations with faith leaders most likely to frame the critical justice debates of 2014. Kevin Ekstrom is the editor-in-chief at Religion News Service, a source of invaluable objective coverage of religion that makes its way onto the most respected news pages in the nation. RNS journalism is also available to you directly at religionnews.com. Welcome back once again, Kevin, to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
I've been talking with Catherine Henderson and Paul Rauschenbusch about progressive religion and voices in it and challenges to it. And I get the feel that people of faith in the progressive tradition are finally coalescing around justice issues in a new way. Am I just too inspired by what they said, or do you have some sense of that as well?
I've been covering religion for 15 years, and I would say there is a larger, more cohesive, louder progressive faith movement than I have seen in a while. What's different and really what's important is that there is now this progressive faith voice that is able to go up against the Christian coalitions and moral majorities and Ralph Reed's of the world. It may not be as loud, it may not be quite as big, but it's there, which wasn't always the case.
Kevin, how much do you think the economic justice message from Pope Francis is helping this?
Oh, I think it's helping a huge amount. I think he's a big part of why this is resonating with people. You have a pope who is wildly popular, both within and without his church. And he is not only a spokesman for this message, but he's living it. So it's an authentic message that people are hearing from him. And so I think it's a combination of the message is resonating, but people are also really responding to the messenger. And nobody has a bigger microphone on this than Pope Francis.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it was Senator Sanders that said they're getting amplification on their social and economic justice issues in the halls of Congress because of the Pope. Is that a fact? And is it a good one or a bad one?
I think it is a fact. The dynamics have shifted. So under Pope Benedict and John Paul II, you heard a lot about capitalism or, you know, the poor, but it was never delivered in such a way that people really paid much attention. And the Catholic right was always able to sort of downplay it and say, well, it's an economic disagreement, it's a political matter, you know, we could agree to disagree. Now what you have is you have a Pope who's very charismatic, who's very popular, who people are actually listening to what he says, and he says them in a way that people can understand. So when the Pope comes out and talks about income inequality, people are listening, and he's saying it in such a way that they can really understand what he's saying. So that gives a bit of armor to the progressive faith community to be able to go up against a Paul Ryan in the Republican House or you know, a conservative Catholic in the Senate who says, oh, economics don't really matter. And now what you're able to do is go and say, no, Pope Francis says that it does matter, and this is what he said about it. And so the stage on this isn't just occupied anymore by the Catholic right. Now the Catholic left has sort of equal footing and a big champion in their corner.
Yeah. Could things like Moral Monday and the ongoing impact of the nuns on the bus actually play a role in the midterm elections?
Yes and no. I think they might be able to play a role in certain places. So, for example, Moral Mondays in North Carolina might be able to help mobilize people behind Senator Kay Hagan, a Democrat who's facing a very tough reelection campaign. It could help there. You know, the nuns on the bus, if they go out again this summer, it could help in certain places. I don't know that it's going to be enough to change the races nationally or change the overall political dynamics going into this election season. But the important thing to remember is that these majorities in Congress are fairly thin. Mm-hmm. So whether or not Kay Hagan gets reelected in North Carolina actually could help determine whether the Democrats or the Republicans control the Senate. So even though they're fairly localized effects, I think if they're effects in the right places, they could have an outcome one way or the other.
You know, the old common complaint that the secular media doesn't do a very good job of covering stories that have a religious component. Is that a factor here or a potential problem in this instance?
Two things come to mind. If you take Moral Mondays, a lot of the coverage about that has been kind of through a political lens. This is a bunch of progressives and liberals and Democrats coming to storm the gates of the Republican state house. It is sort of cast in that light. It becomes Democrats versus Republicans as opposed to people of faith who are really being led by a minister to lobby for minimum wage and worker protections and voting rights and things like that. It becomes a partisan battle. The other thing, I think, when we're talking about Pope Francis, I think there's a lot of the media that gets caught up in the celebrity of this pope. He's on the cover of Rolling Stone and The New Yorker and Time Magazine's Person of the Year, and so he's this kind of global rock star figure. And I think, though, what's good is that people actually are trying to pay attention to his message because his message is so compelling and authentic. But there's a risk that a lot of that can get lost in the paparazzi aspect of coverage of this pope.
I see a risk of sectarianism coming into play as this kind of movement moves forward. It's inevitable that interreligious coalitions eventually run into some bumps in the road, and I just thought that might be one. Do you see the possibility of that?
Yes and no. I mean, my impression from watching, you know, these various movements is that they are less defined by religious labels than they are by a common core purpose, which I guess is actually the way it's supposed to be. But, you know, in North Carolina, you don't see this as a Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, Catholic thing. I mean, this is really, you know, people who are frankly kind of ticked off, all rallying behind, in this case, a minister. So I don't see these as necessarily sectarian fights. Although I think the one piece of this that, you know, doesn't always get as much attention is the secular folks who are rallying as part of this. The progressive movement has as many secular voices and probably more than it does, you know, religious voices.
Right.
So it's important to remember that these are not just religious causes, even though they have a pope or a nun or a black minister out in front.
Yeah. You coordinate coverage of religion and its impact on our secular society in a way that very few people do. What is the greatest challenge you face in doing that?
You know, it's very easy to get jaded and say, oh, that's an old story, or that's, we've done that before. And so, case in point, this week, Gallup came out with its numbers on the most religious and least religious states. And Mississippi was the most religious, and Vermont was the least religious. And, you know, it hasn't changed, probably won't for a while. And so there's a tendency to say, we've been there, we've done that, this story is old news. But yet that's still what people like to talk about. You know, they love numbers and charts and lists and things. So you have to guard against the cynicism that comes with having done this a while. And I think the bigger challenge is to connect the dots, really. You know, so you take a Moral Mondays and you take a Nuns on the Bus and you take Pope Francis. And, okay, each one of those, you know, maybe gets its own story, but there's something going on there. And I think this is what you're talking about, that there's a movement afoot, or there's a trend. You know, something is happening out there. And so putting all that together for readers in a way that they can understand, and frankly in a way that they would care about. You know, why does somebody in Minnesota care what's going on in North Carolina? That can be tough sometimes, but it also makes it what makes it kind of fun is to try to put that puzzle together.
Yeah. Bill Nye, the science guy, or creationist Ken Ham? Who won?
Oh, that's a good question, and it really depends on who you ask. I think, you know, on substance, I think probably Bill Nye, the science guy, won. But on optics, I think it probably goes to the Creation Museum, because the fact that they could engage this issue at all and get all this attention for it. And, you know, the big complaint among atheists was that if we debate these guys, we're going to be taking them seriously and treating them as equals, and we shouldn't do that because they're not. But at the end of the day, you know, the Creation Museum and Ken Ham got their message out. And so to that effect, it was, I think, probably a tie. I think they both scored some points, but in maybe different ways.
Kevin, you are so good. I was convinced that on that one I was going to get a definitive answer, and you balanced it beautifully and probably most fairly. So thank you. Kevin Ekstrom is the editor-in-chief of the award-winning Religion News Service. The press depends on RNS for remarkably broad and even-handed coverage of religion and its influence on our culture, society, and government. And we do too. You can benefit from their journalism at religionnews.com. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Now, before we go, if bad weather had not postponed our scheduled panel discussion on a prophetic vision for a new year, I guarantee you, you would have had a chance once again to hear the voice of author and journalist Jeff Charlotte. Many pages have been written about the significance of the Winter Games taking place in Russia, even as that country has taken giant backward strides on the issue of human rights, particularly for sexual minorities. But Jeff, characteristically, has broken through the noise with a stunningly written piece in GQ magazine titled Inside the Iron Closet, What It's Like to Be Gay in Putin's Russia. The 2014 Winter Games began on Friday and will continue through February 23rd. Despite tragic levels of poverty, The minimum wage is the equivalent of $158 a month. Russia is spending far more on the games, the equivalent of $50 billion, than any host nation in history. It's an investment in burnishing the image of the country and its leader on the world stage. At their best, Olympic competitions can foster international respect and understanding. They can challenge prejudices, as Jesse Owens' achievements did at the 1936 Summer Games in Nazi Germany. But at their worst, the Games can airbrush a nation's human rights abuses and contribute to the power and prestige of tyrannical regimes. Even as we devote a majority of our airtime to domestic issues of fairness and justice, and there are many, we cannot ignore what's going on elsewhere in the world, especially when some so-called pro-family Christian conservatives in this country are singing the praises of Vladimir Putin precisely because of the anti-gay laws his administration has signed into law. And especially when those policies are built on a message and on money brought into Russia by American faith leaders like Scott Lively. Yes, disgustingly, just like in this country, just like in Uganda and elsewhere, Russian homophobia is festering in the name of religion. This week, I'll refer you to some of the actions the Reverend Pat Bumgardner urged us all to take while the Winter Games shine a spotlight on Russia. She was on this show just last week, you'll remember, and you'll find her interview at stateofbelief.com. And I'll also urge you to take a look at Jeff Charlotte's article in the February edition of GQ. It's available online, and we'll link to it from our website. Please keep it in mind as you watch the competition and note who the sponsors are. And we'll work on getting Jeff back on the show, maybe even next week. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. We can only produce this show with the generous support of listeners like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We need it now. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show. Stay in touch with us through the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about this show and join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.